It was a huge pine of such age and character that it offered the thick and widely separated limbs that Jack required. It towered 80 feet or higher, a snow-dusted monolith looming out of the storm, and it was 30 or 35 feet back from the fence, well beyond the farther edge of the alarm grid. Using the StarTron again, Jack studied the massive pine until he found exactly the right branch. It had to be sturdy, yet not much higher than the fence with which it would form the opposing stanchions of a rope bridge. He put the StarTron away again. From one of the rucksacks, he removed the four-pronged grappling hook that had been one of the many items on Ginger's and Faye's shopping list when they had visited Elko earlier in the day. Tied to the hook was a 100-foot length of hawser-laid nylon rope, 5/16 of an inch in diameter, the kind made for serious climbers, and capable not only of holding one of them but of supporting all their weight at the same time. He tested the knot where the line tied to the hook, though he had tested it a dozen times before. He arranged the coil of rope at his feet, stepping on the loose end to prevent the entire length from being carried away when he pitched the grappling hook, but leaving most of it free to pay out. "Stand aside," he said. Dangling the hook from his right hand on 2 feet of line, he began to swing it around and around, faster, faster, until the whoosh of it cutting the air was even louder than the storm wind. When he felt the velocity was right, he let go with his right hand, and the rope slipped loosely through his left hand, trailing after the grapple. The hook arced up and out into the storm. Though it had sufficient mass and momentum to be unbothered by the wind, it fell short of its target by about 3 feet. Jack reeled it back through the snow, churning the virgin mantle. He had to jerk on it a few times, and then patiently finesse it when it got caught on something. He was not concerned about dragging it across the buried, pressure-sensitive grid, for it was not nearly heavy enough to trigger that alarm. In a minute or two, he had it in hand again. Without having been told what to do, Dom had knelt and coiled the rope once more as it came in. Now Jack was ready to try again. His second pitch landed just where he wanted it. The hook firmly snared the target branch. With the grapple securely planted, he took the other end of the rope to the nearest fence post. He slipped it through the chain link, about 7 feet off the ground, wrapped it around the post, threaded it through the chain link on the other side and all the way around the post again. He pulled on it with all his strength until the line between the post and the distant tree was taut. Then he enlisted Dom's and Ginger's help to keep it taut while he knotted it tightly to the post. As a result, they had a rope bridge that was 7 feet off the ground where it began at the fence, angling up to a height of about 9 feet at the tree. That slight incline, even over a mere 35 feet, would make the crossing more difficult, but it was as near to level as Jack could make it. He jumped high, grabbed the line with both hands, swung his body back and forth a few times to get momentum, then kicked up and threw his legs over the rope, crossing his ankles atop it. Like a playful koala bear clinging to the underside of a horizontal branch, he hung with his face turned skyward and his back parallel to the ground. By extending his arms behind him and pulling himself on the line, and by alternately scrunching his legs up and extending them while keeping his ankles locked, he could inchworm along with no danger of touching the ground. He demonstrated the technique for Dom and Ginger. Before he reached the danger zone defined by the pressure-sensitive alarm grid, he let go first with his feet, then with his hands, and dropped to the ground. Dom tried getting onto the line. He attained a hand grip with his first jump, but he needed a full minute to swing his legs up and over, though he did it, then dropped back to the ground. Ginger, only 5'2", had to be given a boost to get a proper hand grip, but to Jack's surprise, she required no assistance to kick up and wrap her legs over the line without delay. "You're in pretty good shape," Jack told her. "Yes, well," she said, swinging back to the ground. "That's because every Tuesday, on my day off, I eat buckets of Veroniki, several pounds of graham cracker cake, and enough blintzes to sink his ship. Diet, Jack. That's the key to fitness. Shrugging his arms through the straps on one of the rucksacks and buckling it in place on his back, Jack said, "Okay. Now, I'll cross the rope bridge first with the two heaviest bags, which leaves one sack for each of you. Ginger, you'll come second. Dom, you'll bring up the rear. When you come across, the rope will sag more the closer you get to the center of the span, even as taut as we've made it. But don't worry. It won't droop far enough to put you in contact with the ground and set off the alarm. Keep your feet locked around the line, and for God's sake, don't accidentally let go with both hands at the same time as you're pulling yourself along. Try to make it all the way to the tree just to be safe. But if your arms and legs give out, you can come down 10 or 12 feet this side of the pine, if you must, which will probably be past the other end of the alarm grid."
"We'll make it all the way," Ginger said confidently. "It's only 30 or 35 feet.
"In just 10 feet, Jack said, fastening the second rucksack to his chest, "you'll feel as if your arms are coming out of their sockets. In 15 feet, you'll feel as if they have come out of their sockets." Something about Brendan Cronin's reaction to his rector's death had jolted Leland Falkirk. When the young priest demanded to be given time and privacy to deliver the last rites to Stefan Vikazic, there had been a fierce fire of indignation in his eyes and such hot grief in his voice that his humanity could not be in doubt. Leland's fear of alien possession was voracious, eating him alive. He had seen, and others had discovered, strange things inside that starship, enough to justify his fear, if not his total paranoia. But even he found it difficult to believe that Cronin's anguish was the clever play-acting of an inhuman intelligence in disguise. Yet Cronin, with his bizarre powers, was one of two prime suspects, one of the two witnesses most likely to have been taken over, the other being Dominic Corvaces. Where did the healing and telekinesis come from, if not from an alien puppet master living within the man's body? Leland was confused. With powdery snow pluming up around his feet, he walked away from the kneeling priest, then stopped and shook his head and tried to clear his thoughts. He saw the other six witnesses by Jack Twist's Cherokee, still under guard. He saw his soldiers, caught between the need to do their duty as they were told, and a confusion worse than Leland's own. He saw the stranger who had been with Vikazic, now up and moving around, miraculously whole. That healing seemed wonderful, an event calling for celebration, not fear, a blessing, not a curse. But Leland knew what lay inside Thunder Hill. That dark knowledge put things in a different perspective. The healing was a ruse, clever misdirection, to make him think the benefits of cooperation with the enemy were too great to justify resistance. They were offering an end to pain, and perhaps an end to all death other than that too sudden to be avoided. But Leland knew the very essence of life was pain. It was dangerous to believe escape from suffering was possible. Dangerous, because such hopes were routinely destroyed, and the pain following in the wake of shattered hopes was far worse than it would have been if you had just faced it and endured it in the first place. Leland believed that pain, physical, mental, emotional, was the core of the human condition, that survival and sanity depended upon embracing pain rather than resisting it or dreaming of escape. You had to thrive on pain to avoid being defeated by it, and anyone who came along with an offer of transcendence must be greeted with disbelief, contempt, and deep distrust. Leland was no longer confused. The big army truck, Georgia supposed it was a troop transport, had hard metal benches along both sides and also against the forward wall that separated the driver's compartment from the rear. Dangling leather loops riveted to the walls at regular intervals, provided those on the benches with something to hang on to when the ride got rough or steep. Father Vikazik's corpse had been laid on the forward bench and secured with lines that tied under the seat and then to the wall straps, forming a rope basket to restrain the body's movement. Everyone else, Georgia, Marcy, Brendan, Ernie, Faye, Sandy, Ned, and Parker, sat on the side benches. Usually, the rear doors were held shut only by the interior latch, allowing soldiers to get out quickly in case of an accident or other emergency. But this time, Colonel Falkirk himself slid the bolt into place on the outside. The sound of it made Georgia think of prison cells and dungeons, and filled her with despair. A fluorescent light was set in the ceiling, but Falkirk did not order it lit. They were forced to ride in darkness. Although Ernie Block had endured the night remarkably well thus far, everyone had expected him to come apart when he was locked in the pitch-black bay of the truck. But he sat beside Faye, holding her hand, and coped. He had periodic bouts of anxiety, marked only by spells of hyperventilation, which he quickly overcame.
"I'm beginning to remember the jets Dom spoke of," Ernie said, soon after they got in the truck, before it started to move. "There were at least four, swooping low. Two very low. And then something else happened, I can't recall. But after that, I remember getting in the motel van and driving like hell down toward I-80, out toward the special place along the highway that means so much to Sandy, too. That's all so far. But the more I remember, the less afraid I am of the dark."
The colonel put no guards in with them. He seemed to think it would be dangerous for even two or three heavily armed soldiers to ride in their company. Before herding them into the truck, the colonel had seemed on the brink of ordering their execution, right there along Vista Valley Road. George's stomach had knotted painfully with fear. Finally, Falkirk calmed down, though Georgia was not convinced he would let them live once they arrived wherever they were going. He had demanded to know where Ginger, Dom, and Jack had gone. At first, no one would respond, which infuriated him. He placed his hand on Marcy's head and quietly told them what pain he would put the child through if they continued to be difficult. Ernie had spoken at once, cursing Falkirk as a disgrace to his uniform, and reluctantly revealing that Ginger, Dom, and Jack had gone west from the Tranquility, heading for Battle Mountain, Winnemucca, and ultimately Reno.
"We were afraid all the routes to Elko would be watched," Ernie said. "We didn't want to put all our eggs in one basket."
It was a lie, of course. For a moment, Georgia wanted to scream at Ernie not to jeopardize her daughter's life with transparent lies. But she realized Falkirk had no way of knowing for sure that it was a phony story. The colonel was suspicious, but Ernie provided more details of the route Jack was supposedly following, and at last Falkirk sent four of his men to check it out. Now, as the truck rumbled and jolted through the windy night toward a destination Falkirk had not shared with them, Georgia hung on to a strap with one hand and held Marcy with her free arm. The girl made things easier by clinging fiercely to Georgia. Her semi-catatonic limpness had given way to a strong need for affection and contact, though she was still by no means connected with reality. But her sudden need to hug and be hugged seemed to Georgia a hopeful sign that she would find her way back from the dark domain into which she had retreated. Georgia would not have believed that anything could distract her entirely from her intense concern about her daughter. But a couple of minutes after the truck started to move, Parker Fane began to tell them why he and Father Vikazik had been making that risky cross-country trek through the snow-swept night. The news he related was so momentous that it pushed everything else from Georgia's mind and held her, rapt. He told them about Calvin Sharkle, about how Brendan had passed on his power to Emmy Hallberg and Winton Toke.
And now, perhaps, to me,
Parker said, with such wonder in his voice that it was communicated instantly to Georgia and caused goose flesh to break out all over her. Parker spoke of the CISG, and he told them what they must have seen on that long-lost summer night in July. Something had come down. Something had come down from the sky, and the world would never be the same again. Something had come down. As that amazing news was revealed, the darkness in the truck was filled with an excited babble of voices. Reactions from Faye's initial stunned disbelief to Sandy's instant and enthusiastic acceptance. Not only did Sandy accept, but she abruptly remembered large pieces of the Forbidden Night, as if Parker's revelation had been a sledge that had struck a wrecking blow upon her memory block.
The jets came over, and the fourth one blew across the roof of the motel, so low it almost took the top off the building, and by that time we were all out of the diner. People were coming over from the motel, but the shaking was still going on. The ground vibrating just like in a quake. The air vibrating, too.
Her tone of voice was a peculiar mix of delight and trepidation, both joyful and haunted. In the darkness, everyone fell silent to hear what she had to say.
Then Dom. I didn't know his name then, but it was Dom, all right. He turned away from the jets and looked up and back across the roof of the diner, and he shouted, "The moon! The moon!" We all turned, and there was a moon, brighter than usual, creepy bright, and for a moment it seemed to be falling on us. Oh, don't you remember? Don't you remember what it felt like to look up and see the moon falling on us?
Yes, Ernie said softly, almost reverently. I remember.
I remember, Brendan said.
And Georgia had a glimmer of memory, the recollected image of a lambent moon, eerily bright, rushing toward them. Sandy said,
Some people screamed, and some started to run. We were so scared, all of us. And the powerful shaking and roaring got louder. You could feel it in your bones, a sound like kettle drums and shotgun blasts all mixed up with the greatest wind you ever heard, though there was no wind. But there was the other sound, too, the queer whistling, warbling, fluty sort of sound under the thunder, getting louder by the second. The moon got very bright all of a sudden. These beams came down from it, lit up the parking lot with a frosty sort of glow, and then changed. The moon turned red, blood red. Then we all knew it wasn't the moon, not the moon, but something else.
Georgia saw, in memory, the lunar form turning from frost white to scarlet. With that recollection, barriers implanted by the mind-control specialists began to crumble like sandcastles under the assault of a high tide. She wondered how she could have looked so often at Marcy's album of moons and not have been nudged toward understanding. Now, understanding came in a flood, and she began to tremble with fear of the unknown and with an indescribable exultation.
Then it came over the diner, Sandy said,
with such awe in her voice that she might have been seeing the starship descend right now, not in memory but in reality, and for the first time.
It came in as low as the jet that had gone before it, but it wasn't moving nearly as fast as the jet. Slow. Slow. Hardly faster than the Goodyear blimp, which seemed impossible, because you could tell it was heavy, not like a blimp. Ever so heavy. Yet it drifted across us so slow. So beautiful and slow, and in that instant we all knew what it was, what it had to be, because it was nothing that had ever been made on this world.
Georgia's tremors grew as the memory returned with greater vividness. She recalled standing in the parking lot of the Tranquility Grill with Marcy in her arms, looking up at the craft. It glided through the warm July night above and would have looked almost serene, except for the thunderous sounds and bass vibrations that accompanied it. As Sandy had said, once the misapprehension of a falling moon was dispelled, they knew instantly what they were seeing. Yet the ship looked nothing like the flying saucers and rockets seen in a thousand movies and television shows. There was nothing dazzling about it, other than the very fact of its existence. No coruscating bands of multicolored lights, no weirdly extruding spines and nodules, no inexplicable excrescences in its design, no unearthly sheen of unknown metal or peculiarly positioned viewports or blazing exhaust or strange, wicked-looking armaments. The enveloping scarlet glow was apparently an energy field by which it remained aloft and propelled itself. Otherwise, it was quite plain. A cylinder of considerable size, though not even as large as, say, the fuselage of an old DC-3, perhaps only 50 feet long and 12 or 15 feet in diameter. It was rounded at each end, rather like two well-worn tubes of lipstick welded together at their bases. Through the shining energy field, a hull was visible, though it was singularly unimpressive, with few features, and none of them dramatic, somewhat mottled, as if by time and great tribulation. In memory, Georgia watched it descend again, across the diner toward I-80, while the jet escorts wheeled and barrel-rolled and swooped and zoomed in the sky above and to the east and west. Now, as on that wondrous night, her breath caught, her heart pounded, her breast swelled with turbulently mixed emotions, and she felt as if she were standing before a door beyond which lay the meaning of life, a door to which she had suddenly been given the key. Sandy said, "It came down, in the barrens beyond I-80. At that place, some of us knew was special, though we didn't know why. The jets were buzzing it. Everyone at the motel and diner just had to get down there. Couldn't hold us back. My God, nothing could have held us back. So we piled in cars and trucks and took off."
"Fay and I went in the motel van," Ernie said out of the darkness in the troop transport, no longer breathing hard, his nyctophobia burned away in the heat of memory. "Dom and Ginger went with us. That pro-gambler, too. Lomac. Zebediah Lomac from Reno. That's why he wrote our names on the moon posters in his house, the ones Dom told us about. Some dim but urgent memory of riding with us in the van down to the ship must have almost busted through his memory block."
"And Georgia," Sandy said, "you and your husband and Marcy and a couple other people rode in the back of our pickup. Brendan, Jack, and others went in cars, strangers, piling in with strangers, but in some way none of us were strangers anymore. When we got there, we parked in the berm, and a couple other cars pulled up, coming west from Elko. People were running across the divider. Cars, driving in from the west, just stopped, right on the highway, and we all gathered on the shoulder of the road for a minute, looking out there at the ship. The glow around it had faded, though there was still a luminous quality to it. Amber now, instead of red. It set some clumps of sagebrush and bunch grass on fire when it first touched down, but those burned out almost entirely by the time we got there. It was funny how we all gathered along the edge of the road, not shouting or talking or noisy in any way, you know, but quiet. All of us so quiet at first, hesitating, knowing we were standing on a cliff, but that jumping off the cliff wasn't going to be a fall. It was going to be like jumping off and up. I can't explain that feeling too well, but you know,
Georgia knew. She felt it now, as she had then, the almost too-wonderful-to-bear feeling that humankind had been living in a dark box, and that the lid had just been torn off at last. The feeling that the night would never again seem as dark and foreboding, or the future as frightening as it had been in the past.
"And as I stood there," Sandy said, "looking out at that luminous ship, so beautiful, so impossible, there on the plains, everything that had happened to me when I was a little girl, all the abuse and pain and terror, didn't matter as much anymore. Just like that."
She snapped her fingers in the dark.
"Just like that, my father didn't terrify me anymore."
Her voice cracked with emotion.
"I mean, I hadn't seen him since I was 14. More than a decade, but I still lived with the fear that someday he'd walk in again, you know, and he'd take me again, make me go with him. That was silly, but I still lived with the fear, 'cause life was a nightmare for me, and in bad dreams those things happen. But as I stood there, watching the ship with everyone silent, and the night so big, the jets overhead, I knew my father could never scare me again, even if he did show up some day, because he's nothing, nothing, just a sick little man, a speck, one tiny grain of sand on the biggest beach you can ever imagine."
Yes, Georgia thought, filled with the joy of Sandy's discovery. Yes, that was what this ship from beyond meant, freedom from our worst and most inhibiting fears. Although the vessel's occupants might bring no answers to the problems that beset humanity, their mere presence was in a way an answer in itself. Her voice thickening even further with emotion, beginning to cry now, not with sadness but with happiness, Sandy said.
"And looking at the ship out there, I felt all of a sudden as if I could put all the pain behind me forever, and as if I was somebody. All my life, see, I felt I was nothing, less than nothing, filthy and worthless, just a thing that had its uses, maybe, but nothing with dignity. And then I realized we're all just grains of sand on that beach. None of us so very much more important than any of the rest of us. But more than that..."
She gave a small cry of frustration.
"Oh, I wish I had words. I wish I had words and knew how to use them better."
"You're doing all right," Faye said quietly.
"By God, girl, you're doing all right."
And Sandy said,
"But even though we're just grains of sand, we're also part of a race that might someday go up there, out there, into all that darkness, out where the creatures in that ship came from. So even as grains of sand, we have a place and purpose. Do you see? We've just got to be kind to one another and keep going. And one day all of us, all the billions of us who were and are, will be out there with those who'll come after us, out there, on top of all the darkness. And anything we ever endured will have been worth it somehow, because it'll have been a part of our getting there. All of that, hidden in a flash while we stood there along the interstate, and suddenly that night right there, I started crying and laughing both."
"I remember," Ned said from his part of the darkness.
"Oh, God, now I remember. I do. It's all coming back. We were standing there on the side of the road, and you grabbed hold of me and hugged me. It was the first time you ever told me you loved me. The first time. Though I'd known you did, you hugged me. You told me you loved me. It was crazy. Right there with a spaceship come down. And you know what? For a few minutes, you holding me and telling me you loved me, the spaceship didn't matter. All that mattered was you telling me. Telling me. After so long.
His voice filled with emotion, too, and Georgia sensed that he was putting his arms around Sandy in the gloom on the other side of the truck.
And they took that away from me. They came with their damn drugs and their mind control, and they took away from me the first time you told me you loved me. But I got it back now, Sandy. And they're never taking it away from me again. Never again.
Faye said plaintively, I still can't remember anything. I want to remember, too. I want to be a part of it.
Everyone was silent as the transport rumbled through the night. Georgia knew the others must be pondering some of the same thoughts that were rushing through her mind. The mere existence of another and superior intelligence put human strife in a different context. Mankind's endless, violent struggles to dominate and enslave, to impress one philosophy or another upon the entire race at any cost in blood and pain, that seemed so hopelessly petty and fruitless now. All narrow, power-centered philosophies would surely collapse. Religions that preached the oneness of all men would probably thrive, but those that encouraged violent conversion would not. In some way, impossible to explain, but easy to feel, just as Sandy had felt it. Georgia was aware that extraterrestrial contact had the potential to make one nation of all mankind, one vast family. For the first time in history, every individual could have the respect that only a good, loving family, no king, no government, could bestow. Something had come down from the sky, and all humankind could be lifted up.
Moon,
Marcy murmured against Georgia's neck.
Moon, Moon.
Georgia wanted to say, everything will be fine, honey. We'll help you remember now that we know what it is you've forgotten. And when you do recall it, you'll realize it's nothing to be scared about. You'll realize it's wonderful, honey, and you'll laugh. But she did not say any of that, for she did not know what Falkirk intended to do with them. As long as they were in the colonel's custody, she did not hold out much prospect for a happy ending. Brendan Cronin said,
I remember more. I remember descending the embankment from the interstate, moving out toward the ship. It lay like shimmering amber quartz. I walked slowly toward it, with the jets swooping overhead, other people coming with me, including you, Faye, and you, Ernie, and Dom, and Ginger. But only Dom and Ginger came all the way to the ship with me, and when we got there we found a door, a round portal, open.
Georgia remembered standing on the shoulder of I-80, afraid to go closer to the ship, and blaming her reluctance on the need to keep Marcy safe. Wanting to call out a warning, and at the same time wanting to urge them on, she had watched Brendan, Dom, and Ginger approach the golden craft. The three had begun to move out of sight along the side of the ship, and everyone still on the shoulder of the highway had rushed eastward 100 feet or so to keep them in view. Georgia had seen the portal, too, a round circle of blazing light on the side of the glimmering hull.
The three of us gathered in front of the door.
Brendan spoke softly, yet his voice carried above the rumble of the truck.
Dom and Ginger and me, we thought something would come out, but nothing did. Instead, there was a
quality about the light inside. The wonderful, golden light I've seen in my dreams. A comforting and compelling warmth that drew us somehow. We were scared. Dear God, we were scared. But we heard helicopters coming, and we sensed government people would take over the second they arrived on the scene. Take over and push us back, and we were determined to be part of it. And that light! So you went inside, Georgia said. Yes, Brendan said. I remember, Sandy said. Yes. You went inside, all three of you. Went inside.
The immensity of the memory was overwhelming. The moment when the first representatives of the human race had set foot for the first time into a place built neither by nature nor by human hands. The moment that forever divided history into before and after. Remembering, their memory blocks having entirely crumbled, no one could speak for a while. The truck rumbled toward its unguessable destination. The darkness within the vehicle seemed vast, yet the eight of them were as close as any people had ever been since the dawn of time. At last, Parker said, "What happened, Brendan? What happened to the three of you when you went inside?" Using the rope bridge, they crossed the pressure-sensitive alarm grid, pausing several times to employ other clever devices in Jack's bag of tricks. They passed through the finely woven web of electronic security that guarded the grounds of Thunder Hill, coming at last to the main entrance. Ginger looked up at the immense blast doors. The blowing snow had stuck and frozen to the burnished steel in cryptic patterns that looked as if they ought to have some meaning. A two-lane blacktop led away from the doors. Heating coils were evidently embedded in it, for not a speck of snow lay on the pavement, and steam rose from its surface. The road curved down and west across the meadow, into the forest, where the lights of the main gate glowed softly in the distance. She could not see the guardhouse, past which they had crept in the pickup, but she knew it was out there. If visitors were admitted during the next few minutes, or if the guards changed shifts and returned to the depository, the jig was up. She and Dom and Jack could scurry off, lie in the snow, hide. However, obviously little traffic passed through here, for the snow around the smaller door was smooth and undisturbed when they arrived. Therefore, the fresh tracks they left would guarantee apprehension as surely as a tripped alarm. They had to get inside quickly, if they had any hope of getting inside at all. The smaller single door to the right of the blast doors looked no less formidable than those giant portals, but Jack was unperturbed. He had brought along an attaché-sized computer called Slicks, and although Ginger had forgotten exactly what the acronym stood for, she knew from Jack that it was a device for penetrating electronic locks of various types, and that it was not for sale to members of the general public. She did not ask where he had gotten it. They worked in silence. Ginger kept a lookout for incoming headlights from the main gate and surveyed the snowy expanse of the meadow for a foot patrol, though they were confident no guards were on prowl. Dom held a flashlight on the 10-digit code board that was the equivalent of a keyhole in an ordinary door, while Jack employed the probes of the Slicks in search of the sequence of numbers that would gain entrance. Crouching on one knee in the snow, alert for trouble, Ginger felt exposed, and much farther than 2,400 miles from her life in Boston. The wind stung her face, the snow melted in her lashes and trickled into her eyes. What a cockamamie situation! Meshuggah! That an innocent person could be driven to such a state as they'd been? Who did this damn Colonel Falkirk think he was? The people who gave him his orders, who did they think they were? Not true Americans. Real momsers. That's what they were, all of them. She remembered the picture of Falkirk in the newspaper. She had known at once that he was a trefniak, a person not to be trusted, not an inch, never. And she knew something else, too. Whenever she began to pepper her thoughts or her speech with this much Yiddish, she must be in deep trouble or very much afraid. Less than 4 minutes after Jack set to work, Ginger was startled by a whoosh of compressed air behind her. She turned and saw the door had already slid into its recess. Dom stumbled back in surprise. Jack fell on his butt. When Ginger went to help him up, he showed her that the door had slid open so suddenly and with such force that he had not had time to withdraw the Slicks probe from the mechanism. It had torn the probe right out of the computer. But the door was open, and no alarms were ringing. Beyond was a 12-foot-long concrete tunnel, about 8 or 9 feet in diameter. It was lit by fluorescent bulbs. It angled to the left, where it ended at another steel door. "Stay here," Jack said, stepping into the tunnel to look around. Ginger stood at Dom's side, and though she knew part of the plan was to give themselves up as hostages, she also knew that, on instinct, she would bolt and run at the first sign of trouble. Dom apparently sensed her thoughts, for he put an arm around her as much to restrain her as to reassure her that she was not alone. After a minute or so, when still no alarm bells or sirens had split the night, Jack stepped back out into the storm and joined them where they stood 6 or 8 feet from the door.
2 surveillance cameras on the ceiling of the tunnel.
They saw you? Dom asked.
I don't believe so.
No.
Because they didn't check my movements. I suspect you have to close the outer door before there's any hope of getting the inner door open. And as soon as you do close the outer door, the cameras are activated. I also noticed some gas jets concealed along the lighting fixtures. Way I see it, you close the outer door, and the cameras look you over, and if they don't like what they see, they can hit you with either a knockout gas or something deadly.
Dom said, "We're ready to be captured, but not gassed like moles."
"We aren't going to close the outer door unless we've already got the inner one open," Jack said.
"But you told us that wasn't..."
"There may be a way," Jack said, winking his cast eye.
The first step was to pile their rucksacks out of the way and cover them with snow. Jack did not think they would have any further need of his high-tech devices and would only be slowed down by the weight. The second step, after they entered the tunnel, was for Dom to lift Ginger so, instructed by Jack, she could use a knife to saw through the wires on the surveillance cameras, putting them out of commission. Again, she expected an alarm to go off, but none did. Leaving the outer door open, Jack led them to the inner barrier.
"This one has no keyboard to disengage the lock, so it doesn't matter that the Slicks was damaged."
"Should we be talking in here?" Ginger asked nervously. "Aren't there liable to be microphones?"
"Yes, but I doubt anyone's monitoring until that outer door closes, because that's probably what engages the computer's attention and starts the clearance program for anyone trying to enter. And even if there's a guard beyond this door, he's not going to hear our voices through all this steel. Not even if we shout," Jack said, though he spoke barely above a whisper.
He pointed to a panel of glass set in the tunnel wall to the right of the door.
"That's the only way to unlock it. They were just starting to install locks like this in high-security installations when I left the service 8 years ago. You put your palm against the glass, the security computer scans your prints, and if you're authorized to enter, the door opens."
"And if you're not authorized to enter?" Dom asked in a whisper.
"The gas jets."
"So how can you open it?"
Ginger asked.
"I can't."
"But you said..."
"I said there might be a way," Jack told her. "And there might."
He looked at Dom and smiled.
"You can probably open it."
Dom stared at Jack as if the ex-thief had lost his mind.
"Me? You serious? What would I know about sophisticated security systems?"
"Nothing," Jack said. "But you have the power to peel thousands of paper moons off walls,
and send them dancing through the air all at once, and you can levitate a score of chairs and perform other nifty tricks. So I don't see why you can't reach into the mechanism of that door and cause it to slide open.
But I can't. I don't know how.
Think about it. Concentrate. Do whatever you did to move the salt shaker last night.
Dom shook his head vigorously.
I can't control the power.
You saw how it got out of hand. What if it runs wild here? I could hurt you or Ginger. I might inadvertently activate the gas jets and kill us all.
No.
No, too risky. They stood in silence for a moment, with the wind huffing and whistling eerily at the open outer door. Jack said,
Dom, if you don't try, then the only way we'll get inside is as captives.
Dom remained adamant. Jack walked back to the outer door. Ginger started to follow him because she thought he was leaving, but he stopped just inside the mouth of the tunnel and raised his hand over a button on the wall. He said,
This is a heat-sensitive switch, Dom. If you won't try to open that inner door, then I'll touch this switch and close the outer door, trapping us here. That'll start the computer's entry clearance program, and when the computer discovers the surveillance cameras have been put out of commission, it'll sound an alarm that'll alert the security men.
One of the reasons we came here was to be caught, Dom said.
We came to have a look around and then get caught, if possible.
Well, Dom said, we'll have to settle for just getting caught.
The tunnel's heat had escaped into the night. Their breath plumed from them again. Those smoking exhalations heightened the impression that the two men were engaged in a battle, though it was a battle of wills rather than one of physical strength. Standing between them, Ginger had no doubt who would win. She liked and admired Dom Corvaces more than any man she had met in a long time, partly because he seemed to embody both the drive and determination of Anna Weiss and the modest shyness of Jacob. He was good-hearted and, in his own way, wise. She would have trusted him with her life. In fact, she had already trusted him with it. But she knew Jack Twist would win, for he was used to winning, while Dom, by his own admission, had been a winner only since the summer before last. Jack said,
If they can't see us, they'll gas us for sure. Maybe they'll just sedate us. But maybe, to be safe, they'll use cyanide gas, or some deadly nerve gas that'll penetrate our clothes, because, after all, they can't be sure we're not wearing gas masks.
You're bluffing.
Am I?
You wouldn't kill us.
You're dealing with a professional criminal, remember?
You were. No more.
Still got a black heart,
Jack said, grinning. And this time there was a disconcertingly maniacal note to his humor and a cold glint in his misaligned eye that made Ginger wonder if he actually might risk killing them all if he didn't get his way.
A dying isn't part of the plan, Dom said. It'll screw up everything.
And your refusal to help? That's not part of the plan either, Jack said.
For God's sake, Dom, do it!
Dom hesitated. He glanced at Ginger.
Step as far out of the way as you can.
She moved back beside Jack Twist.
Dom, if it does come open,
Jack said, still keeping one hand raised over the heat-sensitive switch that would close the outer door,
go through fast. There's a guard in there somewhere.
He'll be real surprised when the door opens because the entry clearance program hasn't been run. If you can knock him down quickly, I'll be right behind you to silence him. That'll improve our chances of getting deeper into the installation and seeing what's to see before they nail our asses.
Dom nodded, faced the inner door again. He looked over the frame, put one hand to the steel, moved his fingertips back and forth in the manner of an old-time safecracker feeling for the telltale vibration of falling tumblers. Then he turned to study the glass panel that read palm prints and fingerprints. Jack lowered his hand from the switch that he had threatened to hit, and glanced at the stormy night beyond the outer door. He whispered so softly to Ginger that Dom, at the far end of the tunnel, could not have heard.
"I get a creepy feeling that any minute now the giant's gonna come down the beanstalk and stomp us all flat."
She knew then that he would not have risked their destruction, that he would probably just have led them out to the guardhouse at the main gate and asked to be arrested. But with his murderous glower, he had been thoroughly convincing. Abruptly, the inner door whooshed open. Even though Dom was the agent of its movement, he was so startled that he jumped back a step instead of rushing through immediately as Jack had told him to do. He realized his error as he made it, and he leapt across the threshold into the subterranean world beyond. Jack hit the button to close the outer door even before Dom was across the inner threshold, then ran after the writer. Ginger followed. She expected the sounds of struggle or gunfire, but heard neither. When she stepped out of the concrete tunnel, she found herself in another huge tunnel with natural rock walls, where lights were suspended from scaffolding overhead. The passage was about 60 feet across, at least 100 yards long, beginning inside the massive steel blast doors and ending far away at what appeared to be banks of elevators. 3 yards in from the door, a guard's table was cemented to the concrete floor. A watchman's log was chained to the table. A few issues of recent magazines were stacked beside the log. There was a computer terminal as well, but no guards were in sight. In fact, the entire tunnel was deserted. The place was as still and silent as a mausoleum. Not even the drip of water from a stalactite or the rustle of bat wings in the vault above. But Ginger supposed that a multi-billion-dollar facility designed to weather World War III would not be plagued by either condensation or flying rodents.
"Should be guards," Jack murmured.
His voice echoed sibilantly off the rock walls.
"What now?"
Dom asked shakily. Clearly, he had been surprised by his ability to focus his power so soon after the near catastrophe in the diner last night.
"Something's wrong," Jack said. "I don't know what. But no guard?
Something's wrong." He skinned back the hood of his ski suit and pulled the zipper down a few inches, and the others did the same. Jack said softly,
"This is just the cargo receiving area. Trucks come in and unload. The main part of the installation must be below us, so I don't like this emptiness. But I guess we go down."
"If we've got to go, then let's stop schmoozing and get a move on,"
Ginger said, heading toward the far end of the tunnel. She heard the inner door swish as Jack closed it. They went farther into Thunder Hill.
2. Fear. They made hardly more noise than 3 mice easing past a dozing cat, yet their footsteps echoed in the rock-walled vault. Not loudly. The echoes did not sound like footsteps, but rather like the whispers and murmurs of conspirators, hidden within the shadowed niches on all sides. Dom's uneasiness grew. They crept past a couple of enormous elevators. Each of them was 70 feet wide and nearly as deep, open platforms that were raised and lowered by synchronized hydraulic shafts at each corner, more than big enough to move fighter aircraft in and out of the bowels of the mountain. They passed smaller cargo lifts, too, and finally came to a pair of standard-size elevators. Before Jack could press the call button for the lift, Dom was hit by another flash of memory. As before, it was sufficiently vivid to displace current reality. This time, he recalled the crucial event of July 6th, the white-to-scarlet metamorphosis of the moon, which suddenly proved not to be the moon at all, but a head-on view of the rounded bow of a descending ship. It was a plain cylinder with few features, None remarkable, almost homely in a way, yet he sensed immediately that its journey, ending here, had not begun anywhere on this world. When the initial power of the memory faded enough to allow reality to impinge upon him once more, Dom found himself leaning against the closed doors of the lift with both hands, his head hanging down between his arms. He felt a hand on his shoulder, turned, and saw Ginger. Jack was standing behind her. She said,
"What's wrong?"
"I remembered. More."
"What?"
Jack asked. Dom told them. He didn't need to convince them that contact with an extraterrestrial craft had been made that summer night. The moment he reminded them of what they'd seen, their own memory blocks crumbled as quickly as his. In their faces, he saw the singularly unique blend of awe, terror, joy, and hope that the event aroused.
"We went inside,"
Ginger said wonderingly.
"Yes," Jack said. "You, Dom, and Brandon."
"But,"
Ginger said,
I can't quite remember what happened to us in there."
"Me neither," Dom said. "That part hasn't come back to me yet. I recall everything, up to the minute we went through the hatch, into that golden light. Then, nothing."
For a moment, they were oblivious of their perilous surroundings. Ginger's lovely, delicate face was bone white. Partly it was the bloodless look of fear, but not fear alone. Dom now understood, as Ginger did, why they had responded to each other so powerfully the instant that she had gotten off the plane at the Elko County Airport on Sunday. That summer night, they went into the ship together and shared something that had forever bonded them.
"The ship's here, inside Thunder Hill," she said. "It must be."
Dom agreed. "That's why the government took the land away from those ranchers. They enlarged the grounds of the depository to make it more difficult for anyone to spot the truck that brought the ship in." Jack said,
"It would have been a hell of a big load."
"Like those huge trucks they haul the space shuttle on," Dom said. Jack said,
"Yeah, but why would they hide what happened?"
"I don't know," Dom said. He tapped the button that would summon the elevator.
"But maybe we can find out."
The elevator arrived with a quiet hum, and they rode down to the second level. Judging from the length of the ride, the top two floors of the installation were separated by several stories of solid rock. The doors opened at last, and they stepped into an immense, circular cavern 300 feet in diameter. From far above, the scaffolded lights shed wintry beams on an odd collection of sheet metal buildings that hugged the walls most of the way around the chamber. Warmer light shone at small windows in two of those structures. Otherwise, they were dark and appeared untenanted. Dom thought it looked a little like a film crew on location, a bunch of dressing room trailers. Four large caverns branched from the main chamber, one of which was closed off by huge wooden doors that were curiously primitive for an otherwise highly modern facility. In the three adjacent open caverns, lights glowed, and Dom saw stored equipment, jeeps, troop carriers, trucks, helicopters, and even jet aircraft, in addition to other trailer-like buildings with more lights at the windows than those in the main chamber. Thunder Hill was an enormous arsenal and a self-sustaining subterranean city, which Dom had known, but he had not guessed at the immensity of it. More mystifying than the depository's many wonders was its air of abandonment. The second level was as deserted and silent as the first. No guards, no busy personnel, no voices or sounds of labor. True, the caverns were slightly cool, and at this time of the evening most of the staff would probably keep to the heated living quarters. But a few should have been in sight, and if most were off duty there should have been music, TV, voluble poker game conversations, and other muted recreational sounds wafting from the farther reaches of the facility.
In a whisper, so thin it was little more than a sub-vocalization, Ginger said,
"Are they all dead?"
"I told you,"
Jack said in an equally quiet voice.
"Something's wrong."
Dom felt drawn toward the huge wooden doors, almost 3 stories high, at least 60 feet wide, that sealed the entrance to the fourth cavern. So he allowed his feelings to guide him. Followed by Ginger and Jack, he walked as quietly as he could toward a smaller, man-sized door set in the bottom of one of those giant wooden portals. It was ajar, and a wedge of light, brighter than that in the main cavern, fell out onto the stone floor. He put one hand upon the door to pull it open, then stopped when he heard low voices inside. He listened until he ascertained there were only two of them, both men. They were speaking too softly for him to follow their conversation. Dom considered turning back, but he had a hunch that if he had an opportunity to look into any one room before being apprehended, he could do no better than this one. He pulled open the small door in the huge door and walked through. The ship was there. Ginger stood with one hand on her breast, as if to restrain her heart from hammering loose. The cavern beyond the wooden doors was enormous, fully 200 feet long, and varying between 80 and 120 feet in width, with a high, domed ceiling. The rock floor had been chiseled, planed, and abraded to form a level surface from wall to wall. All the deep holes and crevices had been filled with concrete. Judging from scattered oil and grease stains, and from recessed ring bolts in the floor, the chamber had once been used for storing or servicing vehicles. To the right of the entrance, along the wall, were more trailer-like buildings with small windows and metal doors, a dozen, stretching almost to the end of the chamber. Though probably used as offices or living quarters at one time, they had been converted to research facilities. Hand-lettered signs were fixed to some doors. Chem Lab, Chem Library, Pathology, Biolab, Biolibrary, Physics 1, Physics 2, Anthropology, and others too far away to read. In addition, work tables and large machines, a conventional X-ray unit, a large sound spectrograph of exactly the kind in use at Boston Memorial Hospital, and many other pieces of equipment Ginger did not recognize, stood in rows or clusters in the open area immediately in front of the metal buildings, as if someone were conducting a sidewalk sale of high-tech laboratory equipment. The amount of research to be done had outstripped the available quarters, which was no surprise, considering the object of the inquiry. The ship from another world lay to the left of the entrance. It looked exactly as Ginger had recollected minutes ago, when the forbidden memory had at last pushed through the block and returned to her. A cylinder between 50 and 60 feet long, 15 feet in diameter, rounded at both ends. It had been set upon a series of 5-foot-high steel trestles to keep it off the floor, rather like a submarine in dry dock for repairs. The only thing different from its appearance on the night of July 6th was the absence of the eerie glow that had changed from moon white to scarlet to amber. It possessed no visible propulsion system, no rockets. The hull was nearly as featureless as she recalled. Here, a 10-foot-long row of shallow depressions in the metal, each big enough for her to insert her fist, but without evident purpose. There, 4 protruding hemispheres like halves of cantaloupes, also without apparent function. Here and there, 6 circular elevations, some as large as the lid of a trash can, some no bigger than the mouth of a mayonnaise jar, none higher than 3 inches, all quite mysterious. Otherwise, but for the marks of wear and age, the long, curving hull was smooth over 98% of its surface. Yet its unspectacular design did not prevent it from being by far the most spectacular thing Ginger had ever seen. She was simultaneously terrified and joyous,
overcome with a dread of the unknown yet exultant. Two men were sitting at a table at the foot of portable stairs that led up to an open hatch in the flank of the elevated spacecraft. The most imposing was a lanky man in his 40s, with curly black hair and beard, wearing dark trousers, dark shirt, and white lab coat. The other was in an army uniform with the jacket unbuttoned, a somewhat portly man 10 years older than his bearded companion. Now, seeing their three visitors, they fell silent, rose from their chairs but did not shout for guards or rush to trip an alarm switch. The two merely watched Dom, Jack, and Ginger with interest, gauging their first reactions to the trestled craft that loomed over them. They were expecting us, Ginger thought. That realization should have concerned her, but it did not. She had no interest in anything but the ship. With Dom close by her right side and Jack on her left, she moved with them in silence to the nearest end of the cylindrical vessel. Although her heart had begun beating hard and fast the moment she had entered the chamber and seen the ship, its previous pounding was mild compared to its current, furious hammering. They stopped within an arm's length of the hull and studied it with an attitude of wonder bordering on veneration. Random, swirling patterns of fine-grain abrasion swept across the entire curving bulk of it, as if it had persevered through clouds of cosmic dust or particles of a type and origin as yet unknown to man. Random nicks and small dents were scattered across the surface, clearly not part of the design, but inflicted by elements far more hostile than the winds and storms that battered the ships of Earth's seas and skies. The hull was mottled gray, black, amber, brown, as if bathed in 100 different acids and scorched in 1,000 fires. Aside from its intrinsic and powerful alienness, the strongest impression Ginger got from the ship was a sense of great age. For all she knew, it could have been built only a few years ago and could have journeyed to Elko County at faster-than-light speeds, arriving on the night of July 6th, just a few months or a year after being launched. But she did not think that was the case. She could not ascertain the source of her conviction, call it intuition, but she was certain that she was standing in the shadow of an ancient vessel. And when she reached out and touched the cool metal, letting her fingertips move lightly over its scarred and finely abraded surface, she felt even more strongly that she was in the presence of a venerable relic. They had come such a long way, such a very long way. Following her lead, Dom and Jack had touched the hull, too. Dom took a deep, quaverous breath. His was more eloquent than any words could have been.
"Oh, how I wish my father could have lived for this," Ginger said, remembering dear Jacob the Dreamer, Jacob the Luftmensch, who had always loved tales of other worlds and distant times. Jack said, "I wish Jenny lived longer, just a little longer."
Ginger suddenly realized that Jack did not mean the same thing she meant, that he was not saying he wished his Jenny had lived to see this vessel. He was wishing she had lived through these events because, as a result of this extraterrestrial contact, Brendan and Dom had acquired the power to heal her. If she had not succumbed on Christmas Day, they might have been able to go back to her, assuming they got out of Thunder Hill alive, and might have knit up her damaged brain, bringing her out of her coma, returning her to the arms of her devoted husband. That jolting moment of comprehension made Ginger aware that she had hardly begun to grasp the implications of this incredible event. The portly man in the military uniform and the bearded man in the lab coat had walked over from the table near the ship's portal. The civilian put his hand to the hull, which Ginger and Dom and Jack were still exploring. He said, "An alloy of some kind, harder than any steel produced on this world, harder than diamond, yet extremely light and with surprising flexibility. Your Dom Corvaces." "Yes," Dom said, offering his hand to the stranger, a courtesy that would have surprised Ginger if she had not also sensed that this mild-spoken scientist and the military man with him were not their enemies. "I'm Miles Bunnell, director of the team studying this wonderful event, and this is General Alvarado, commanding officer of Thunder Hill. I can't tell you how deeply I regret what's been done to you. This shouldn't be a secret possessed by a few. It belongs to the world. And if I had my way, the world would hear about it tomorrow." Bunnell shook Jack's and Ginger's hands, too. Ginger said,
"We have questions."
"And you deserve answers," Bunnell said. "I'll tell you everything we've been able to learn. But we might as well wait until everyone's assembled. Where are the others?" "What others?" Dom asked. And Ginger said,
"You mean from the motel? They're not with us."
Bunnell blinked in surprise. "You mean most of them managed to slip through Colonel Falkirk's hands?"
"Falkirk?"
Jack said. "Do you think he brought us here?" Bunnell said, "If not Falkirk, who?" "We came in ourselves," Dom said. Ginger saw the shock of that news register with both Bunnell and General Alvarado. They looked at each other in surprise, and then a light of hope lit both their faces. Alvarado said,
"You're not telling us you found a way through the depository security? But that's not possible."
"Have you read the file on Jack?" Bunnell asked his friend. "Yes?" "Well, just remember his ranger training and what he's been doing for a living these past 8 years or so." Jack shook his head.
"I can't take all the credit.
Yeah, I got us through the perimeter, across the grounds, and past the first door. But it was Dom who actually got us inside."
"Dom?" Bunnell said, turning in surprise to the writer.
"But what do you know about security systems?"
"Unless..."
"Of course. This strange damn power of yours. Since that experience in Lomax House, and since the light you generated when Cronin first arrived at the Tranquility, you must have discovered the power wasn't external. You must know now that it's actually in you."
Ginger realized that Bunnell's statement had revealed that their conversations at the Tranquility had, indeed, been monitored. But it also revealed that their discussions and strategy sessions in the diner, after Jack's arrival, had not been penetrated. Otherwise, Bunnell would have known about the experiment last night, in which both Dom and Brendan had learned that